Thanks for listening on Friday, January 24th, 2014, on the In Depth with Francis Rose, 4:08, and it's the Federal News Countdown every Friday in the 4 o'clock hour. I have two experts in the world of the federal government that have chosen the news stories from this week that they think are the three most important to people who work for the federal government, and they are Robert Shea, principal at Grant Thornton, and also you now have a new thing that you're involved with, the National Academy of Public Administration.
That's right. I've been involved with NAPA for a long time, but just got elected chairman of the board.
Oh, congratulations.
National Academy of Public Administration.
That's a big deal. That's like you're not just going over there and, you know, rifling through the refrigerator. That's a big deal.
It's good work if you can get it. I'm very proud.
Well, congratulations on that. And Dan Blair is the president and CEO of that organization.
That's right.
He's a friend of the show, and so you have a terrific person to work with there.
Yeah, I sure do.
Well, congratulations on that. I'm happy to do it. Deborah Roth is a partner in the law firm Shaw, Bransford & Roth, and is one of the co-hosts of Fed Talk, Fridays at 11 o'clock on Federal News Radio, and you're my other expert. It's great to see you, Debbie. Thanks for coming in
today.
Thank
you, Francis, for inviting me.
Always a pleasure. And you have each chosen three stories that you think are the most important to people who work in the government this week. Robert, start with you. Your third most important story is from Fierce Government, and the headline is, Federal Government Should Reform Programs That Affect State Governments. Brookings paper says, and the relationship between the federal government and the state governments, it seems to me, has gotten more tenuous because of the budget situation. It was at this event yesterday that your friend Dan Blair, speaking of NAPA, was a panelist at, and the number came out of there that 42% of state government funding comes from the federal government. So that relationship becomes tremendously fragile, I would imagine, in a time like now.
Well, even with reductions, the amount of money that the federal government pours into state and local governments is immense. How that money's managed has always been problematic. As money gets tighter, we need to do a better job getting the most out of those investments. But we also need to get out of the way, in many cases, of state and local governments, because a lot of what they're doing, if they are the laboratories of this country, we ought to do a better job looking at what they're doing, measuring its impact, and sharing that information across the government.
The story says, the paper says the federal government should restore OMB's Intergovernmental Relations Office because it would be a natural extension of OMB's mission to assess the fiscal and policy dimensions of government programs. Was that around when you were at OMB still?
It was not, and people bemoaned the loss of some entity to help collaboration among the federal, state, and local governments. I'm agnostic about where that exists, but somebody's got to fill that hole of bringing federal, state, and local governments together so that they can work on working better together.
When I read this story and I consider some of the things that the federal government sends money to the states for, Medicaid, loans, programs, and so on, it's not something I think of off the top of my head, but on further consideration, it's a much bigger deal than it looks on the surface.
That's right. And a lot of that money comes in different forms from different agencies, even though it's aimed at the same thing. A lot of poverty programs. We've had a lot of talk recently about the war on poverty, how well or not it's done. You've got this proliferation of programs managed from different agencies with different requirements. The complexity is mind-boggling. I think we could do a lot better by reducing some of that complexity, focusing our oversight on what's working.
The paper says the federal government should also make sure its funds are going to regional projects in states rather than those that are purely local. Because it strikes me that when you're talking about local programs, that sounds almost like a synonym for earmarks, where a regional program is something that potentially could have more impact. Is that your sense of what the authors are getting at?
I think the suggestion is if you break this up into bigger chunks or group it into bigger chunks, it's easier to manage.
Mm-hmm. The third most important federal news story of the week is selected by Robert Shea, is from Fierce Government, and the headline is Federal Government Should Reform Programs That Affect State Governments, Brookings paper says. Deborah, your third most important federal news story of the week is from the Washington Post. It's Josh Hicks's story. Mm-hmm. Headline, Federal Employment Projected to Drop Through 2022. This is not necessarily bad. It doesn't look like good news on the surface, but it's not necessarily bad news because there's no implication here that anybody's going to get riffed, that anybody is going to lose a job. It just kind of goes to, it sounds to me like it's going more toward downsizing kind of naturally through the government doing different things.
Yeah, you know, it's not, it's certainly not clear how BLS came up with, I didn't go back and figure out, well, how did they come up with that number? For me and the work I do, servicing the federal workforce and the work our law firm does for the Senior Executive Association, you look at that number and you look at the loss of jobs, you have to take out Postal Service. Postal Service currently, of the 2.7 million workers, is about 600,000.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you have 2.1 million federal employees go to work every day for the executive branch, and they're already complaining that there's not enough of them. Whether you, you know, wherever you fall on the side of that, is there enough of them to get the job done? You know, if you're projecting in X number of years a 13% reduction, certainly I don't think anyone's projecting an increase in, you know, financial resources available at that rate to, you know, federal workers. You know, if you're a federal worker, what does that mean for you? This really is about, you know, going to work every day and having to do a lot more with less. That's a big number to drop. They don't say how.
Mm-hmm. And there is a link in this story to the BLS projections. What I find interesting and maybe comforting for those federal employees, though, Deborah, is that I get a sense that with the exception of 535 people who shall remain nameless, the idea of doing more with less, it pretty much has jumped the shark. I don't think there's anybody that really believes, short of utilizing technology a lot more efficiently, that that's really going to happen, and that this is a matter of prioritizing what the agencies need to do and deciding what the agencies aren't going to do anymore. Of course, the problem is the final decision is made by those 535 nameless people,
right,
that
who,
I just referred
did,
to.
You know, who did get their act together and give some direction down to the agency levels, but they didn't have that direction for several years.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of doing more with less, they also didn't know what they had and in what increments they had it. But it's certainly not a projection of growth. And so the idea to federal workers that you're going to get more to get your job done, that is not, you know, this is a stark reality. I mean, I think we all knew that intuitively, but this is the stark reality. And there are other things out there indicating very clearly, my number one story.
Don't give it away.
I'm not that, that this is where they're headed. And, you know, if they're unhappy now with the amount of resources they have to get it done, I really do think it's very related in many ways to what everybody's talking in town, and certainly very related to Robert's number three story. You have to find ways, and when they were forced in the sequester to find ways to be more efficient with the money they had, you know, turned out absent furloughs, many agencies found ways to be more financially responsible. And I think the American public is pleased with that, absent the furloughs.
The third most important federal news story of the week. And don't spoil your stories, for heaven's sakes, Deborah. Your third most important federal news story of the week is from the Washington Post. The headline is federal employment projected to drop through 2022. That and all of our stories on this week's countdown linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. And the countdown continues in a moment with the second most important stories of the week from Deborah Roth and Robert Shea. And I'll clear my throat and be back in a minute on In Depth with Francis Rose. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Deborah Roth and Robert Shea. And we're up to
number two.
Deborah Roth, your second most important federal news story of the week is from the Huffington Post. The headline is U.S. likely to hit debt ceiling sooner than believed. And I take a little bit of encouragement from this because it's the only kind of shutdowns, work stoppage thing that still looms out there as a possibility, given where we were, you know, 6 months ago or a year ago. It's not great in and of itself, but at least this is the only thing that's a potential shutdown deal.
Yeah, that's a double-edged sword because...
Well, I'm always looking for the...
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword because, all the media and all the talk is... You know, sort of the obvious when you're inside the beltway, which is you know, it's primary season mm-hmm. and it's midterm elections. And so to what extent is this vote become more important to the party, you know, to each of the parties than for the years? Because, Francis, you and I have been on this show several times in the last 3 or 4 years, you know, talking about the next cliff we got to mm-hmm. and all the rhetoric and are we going to hit it or not. So, you know, it's hard to tell. I don't know. I think that the conventional wisdom is there'll be all this rhetoric and we won't blow the debt ceiling.
Right.
But, you know, I don't think most people thought they would shut the government. So, you know, I think the people outside the Beltway just couldn't fathom that. You know, so it's hard to tell, but it's like, I agree with you. It's the last one, and it was like just when you were feeling sort of peace and quiet and calmness and we're past all this, it's like, oh, no, it's back, and it's back accelerated because they've just determined, you know, that the deadline that they thought the Treasury Department was predicting got accelerated by a few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So does the acceleration help or hurt getting to the final resolution?
Well, our Hill veteran, Robert Shea over here, do you think it helps or hurts, or does it make any difference?
Well, I think it pushes resolution sooner. And I don't think just because we got a 2-year budget deal means brinkmanship is gone from politics in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be some of it. I do not think that Republicans in Congress, at least those that are in charge, have an appetite for the kind of things we went through in the fall. I think there will be a deal. I suspect there'll be some sort of fig leaf, if not more, from the White House as part of the debt deal, just to get us through this crisis.
My sense of this, Deborah, is right along the lines of what Robert's talking about, and it's for one thing. I get a sense from folks that I talk to on the Hill, especially on the Senate side, that I don't think there's anybody that thinks that the Democrats really have much of a chance to take the House back in the fall. I get a sense that as we continue to see races in the Senate, like in North Carolina, where Senator Hagan, who by all accounts has been a kind of a middle of the road, has projected a pretty moderate image in that state. The Republican governor and the Republican legislature in North Carolina are not particularly popular, and yet she's having a lot of trouble because she voted for the Affordable Care Act. My sense is that Republican senators want to keep attention focused on that, on the Affordable Care Act and the issues that go around that, rather than getting wrapped up in something like the debt limit that could make them look bad.
Except, you know, beyond this one reporting of the news that, you know, the Secretary of Treasury sent the letter over to the Speaker of the House, you know, there's what people are saying now that it's accelerated, what they want out of it. And Boehner's own office, you know, they released a press release and saying while they don't think they're going to blow the debt limit, you know, the idea of a clean debt limit increase simply won't pass in the House. So then they read beyond the story and it's like, well, what are people looking for? And so you know, they're looking for what they've always said for the last however many years they've been saying they're looking for it. So they want for the whatever the increases in the debt ceiling, they want that in revenue. You know, they want that in reduction, you know, of deficit.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's people saying, you know, that they want changes, you know, they want changes to Obamacare statute. So you can get the conversation about Obamacare back into the debt limit this way. And then the president yesterday, once all this was floating to the top, he said, I'm not negotiating.
Yeah.
So you say fig leaf, he's consistently said he's not negotiating. Does anyone really believe that they would blow the limit? I think no. The other thing that floats around this town is that extreme part of the party that thinks, what's the harm? There really is no harm in blowing the debt limit. Give it a try. Let's give it a try. See what happens.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very – I think it's still hard to predict. I think that the 2-year budget deal is an incredible indicator of the ease that the you know that we should get past the debt ceiling. But these guys have sort of played tricks on us before.
You know what bugs me about this story? So Jack Lew sent a letter to Boehner, and he sent a previous letter. Boehner's guy issued a statement Who writes letters to anybody anymore? Why aren't they picking up the phone or sitting down and talking about this? That's what got us into trouble. Nobody was talking.
Uh-huh.
They ought to sit down and talk to each other about
well,
it.
Well, we don't know for sure that that's not going on, that these are not just formalities that convey this information for public consumption. But
I read from this that there's not a lot of talking going on if you have to send a letter to say this without having a constructive, substantive in-person conversation.
Is that dramatically different, though, from the way this information was conveyed, say, under Secretary Geithner at the Treasury Department? Because he went through a couple of these.
That's right. I think we're in a rather long period where people are not sitting down and having these conversations. The two-year budget deal was an anomaly and I think gave a lot of people great hope. What Deborah's suggesting is we might be let down again in the near future. I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so either. But they've been unpredictable.
That's right. That's right.
Ladies and gentlemen,
and it,
the
and
understatement
it,
of the week.
Right.
Congress has been unpredictable.
And they've drawn things out in timelines that you would just never imagine were possible.
The second most important federal news story of the week is selected by Deborah Roth. It's from the Huffington Post. U.S. likely to hit debt ceiling sooner than believed. And remember that nugget, Robert. Congress has been unpredictable. It's the story of the week. Second most important federal news story of the week is selected by Robert Shea. It's from federalnewsradio.com. The headline is Obama signs $1.1 trillion government spending bill. And this is, of course, the bill that we've been talking about in the program already that will prevent government shutdowns. This agreement, to me, isn't just the FY14 deal either. It's the FY15 top line that's been agreed to that pretty much, can we say, is it too early to say that we're out of the shutdown business until next September 2015?
I'm pretty confident, looking at Deborah,
fingers crossed,
we're not going to have another shutdown. I suspect we're looking at continuing resolutions that get us beyond the election so that somehow one party or the other will have an advantage.
So regular order is too much to ask for at this point.
Regular order is too much to ask for and has been for about two decades. So that's right. I think
you've crushed my dreams.
I'm sorry.
You didn't do it on purpose, I'm sure.
One of the points I was trying to get at picking this story was that the president – walked across the street to the offices of the civil servants at the Office of Management and Budget, congratulating them and thanking them for their hard work. They went through furloughs like many other agencies. They've got to administer this behemoth budget deal at the same time they're producing the president's budget, which is going to be delayed until March, we hear.
March 4th is what we have on federalnewsradio.com.
But good for the president for going over and congratulating some of the hardest working people in government.
What do you think the significance of that is, Deborah? Because for a long time, the president has been hesitant, it seems, to really embrace the federal workforce. And I've heard from some union people who you would think would be friendly to the administration and others who are saying, come on, you got to pretend that we're alive. 5-6 years ago, you said you wanted to make government a place that was cool to work at, and nothing. We hardly see you.
You know, I think most federal workers feel not supported at the very top. And so for organized associations and labor unions, I think that what they would say about the president has been a little late to the table, you know, that the political strategy and the political strategizing is what goes on. And then afterwards, it's, oh, and by the way, you guys are great, you know, which is the letter he sent out at the end of the shutdown.
Mm-hmm.
And he has created an impression in many federal employee minds and at these very large levels of organizations, federal employee organizations and unions, that he really doesn't care about, you know, the management of the workforce, driven maybe by results, but not necessarily about the people, and that they've become the pawn in all of this. You know, is that true or not? Who knows? The reality is that they did become the pawn in many of these discussions back and forth for the last 3 years. I think for the federal workforce, Robert's number two story is a huge thing. To me, it's a huge, obvious, it's the story of the year. It's the story of the decade. They passed a budget.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't congratulate, you know, this is what I say. And you have to remind members, you know, 535 of them, it's their constitutional duty. That's what they get paid to do, is to do appropriations. So to pass it to the Senate and go, you go first, really not their job. Their constitutional duty, which they get paid to do and which they got paid during furloughs and shutdowns to do, was to pass a budget. Now, for the actual worker bees in the federal government, you know, to have a budget for a year, oh, my God. To have a budget for 2 years, I mean, the idea that you could actually be able to plan and think ahead and strategize. And at the summit you and I were at yesterday, to be able to have money today that you can think about for the next – this budget cycle and the next really helps on Robert's first story about thinking about being more efficient about how you spend money as opposed to trying to, like, deal with your money issues in 90-day increments. So passing a budget is a huge story for federal workers. You know, do they feel good about how it all played out? I think they are worn down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're just worn down by the whole exercise.
The idea that we would have CRs from October 1st to after the election is not an optimal outcome. But maybe, is it maybe a little bit better because it's coming off an appropriated bill that the president just signed, as the story talks about, rather than, what, 10 years or so of
CRs last year,
have just been stretched out?
Last year we were operating under a long-term continuing resolution. This year we've got appropriations, so people are going to get a lot done between now and the end of the fiscal year. Those programs can continue, of course, beyond the end of the fiscal year under a continuing resolution. So, yeah, I think you're right to point out that it's tremendously better than if it were just – the budget minus a little bit from 2 years ago.
The second most important federal news story of the week is selected by Robert Shays from federalnewsradio.com. The headline is Obama signs $1.1 trillion government spending bill. It and all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. And we'll check out the most important federal news stories of the week, the top of the chart, next on In Depth with Francis Rowe. Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Robert Shea of Grant Thornton and Deborah Roth of Shaw, Bransford & Roth. And we're up to
number one.
The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Deborah Roth, is from federalnewsradio.com. It's Jason Miller's story, headlined OPM to RIF, 300 workers from HR Solutions Office. And I have to confess, Deborah, when this information first crossed, when we got it here before Jason put it together to put it out, I personally fell into the same, kind of habit that everybody does. As soon as you see the letters RIF, you just go, your eyes bug out like on cartoons, you know, when they go, woo, because you hardly ever hear that, and yet here it was. And this didn't, certainly for these 300 folks, this is not good news, but 300 compared to what people have been predicting for a long time is not tremendously large. What did you see when you heard about this?
I think OPM's out in front, and they're saying, you know, if we can do it, you can do it. And I think, you know, that the OPM director isn't, you know, I don't know. I haven't had a conversation with her, but, you know, I think that's the intent. I mean, right out in front, right in January, right after the budget is signed. So this was obviously known, you know, plans in advance. You know, and they're saying it's because of the budgetary environment. It is about a shortage of funds, and that the service that this office provided in hiring and training, and it ties to my number three story, you know, they're doing much less of it during budget constraint times. They're doing a lot less hiring and training. You know, that the need of that office has really dramatically declined, thus the need for RIFs. RIF notices supposedly came out this week. And to be able to conduct a RIF and have people off the rolls by March 28th, that's a signal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a signal, I think, to the rest of the government, where a lot of people said once the budget deal got passed and some sequestration levels had been lifted, you know, you get the questions in town, well, what do you think that means for RIFs? And so you sort of get the sense, well, maybe it was lightening the need for RIFs, and then there it is. You know, right there in January, OPM is running a RIF. So I do think it's significant because I think we will be seeing, even though we have a budget and, you know, sequestration levels have been lifted in some instances, and some agencies have done better in this budget than in, you know, past CRs, I do think we're going to now see RIFs.
Will we see, do you think, some of the other personnel actions like buyouts and early outs and things like that too? Or will it be more of this, do you think?
In the 90s, with Al Gore's, you know, reinvention of government, they started with the Vera VSUP, the buyout. But then that's when they had funds. So it's hard to say. DOD's always said, we're going to run a RIF regardless. And I don't think, you know, they're in the Vera VSUP world. So in the places, the big places where they're going to run RIFs, you know, I think Vera VSUP is going to be driven by, do they have the funds to pay for that? Otherwise, there's no Vera VSUP here, and it's OPM, and they're running a RIF.
Mm-hmm. The other thing about this story that struck me, Robert, as I dug into it, is 300 positions sounds like a fair amount of people, but the email from OPM says, we're abolishing over 300 positions nationwide. The majority of these are intermittent, so they're not permanent employees, and about 25% are full-time positions. That's 75. So that makes the whole thing look a little less urgent. I mean, certainly, again, to those 75 people, it's a big deal. But this story details some of the efforts that OPM is going to try to help those folks find jobs by the time that these RIFs take effect.
Which is great. I mean, I think they're doing the right thing to help these people. The spending cuts are an admission of reality, that the reliance on these services are limited. It's also, I think, notable that HRS is an entity that's been under increasing scrutiny from the Hill for not having adequate accountability. And I think the appropriations bill gave the inspector general some resources to dig a little into those operations and make sure that everything was had run with integrity.
So potentially a preemptive strike before the IG has a chance to dig into this and make some recommendations?
I think that's right. I think that's right. Not one of the favorite entities on the Hill, and so I think they might be trying to clean up their act in advance.
The RIF is happening, according to Joseph Kennedy, Associate Director of HRS, because it's ending its nationwide testing program. Kennedy also said OPM's rescoping other program areas to align with current and future human capital needs of agencies. Deborah, this is maybe a very teeny, 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 tiny indicator of what I suggested earlier, that agencies are thinking about things that they can't or don't have to do anymore and making changes accordingly, maybe?
Yeah, and the obvious is, like my number three story, they're clearly hiring less. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you're hiring less, you don't need your folks in these kinds of offices. So I think in many ways this is an indicator of many things. It's a forecast of many things inside of OPM and for the greater government. But for the obvious story for federal news, for federal employees across the area, is when they hear OPM's running a RIF, that makes them very nervous.
The most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Deborah Roth, is from federalnewsradio.com. It's Jason Miller's story headlined, OPM to RIF 300 Workers from HR Solutions Office. And it's linked, like all of our countdown stories, at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Robert Shea. We'll wrap up this week's federal news countdown next on In-Depth with Francis Rose. Be right back. This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown, most important federal news story of the week, is selected by Robert Shea, is from Government Executive. It's Tom Shoup's story headlined, A Crusader for Limited Government to the End. And it is about Senator Tom Coburn. Now, we have talked about Senator Coburn on this program on a number of occasions. And Senator Coburn's been a guest on this program on a number of occasions. Why is this a big loss in your view, Robert? Why is this a story that has a potential, as we talked about before we went on the air, to resonate not just this week, but for the foreseeable future?
So we talk a lot. We've talked a lot in this hour about the unreasonable right. And Coburn probably is thought by many to be among the voices on the unreasonable right. But really, he is one of the most principled, hardworking, smartest members of the Senate, and has been a really forceful, effective advocate for smaller government. He has stood up and said, I'm happy to support that program, but you got to find a way to pay for it. Because as good as we've done at cutting the budget, we still are in deficit spending and need to do a lot more to get our debt down. And he's been the most effective advocate for stopping spending that isn't otherwise paid for. He's been one of the the biggest proponent of greater transparency in government. He got every federal transaction reported on the internet within 30 days, which they said could not be done. He's term limited. He was going to go out at the end of this term anyway, but he's ill. And whether or not that's the reason, he's decided to retire, and it's going to be a big loss of a really smart, hardworking, effective legislator. You know, one of the things he did was pass a simple requirement, the GAO report on the extent of overlap and duplication every year. So every year, GAO puts out a report that says, we've got a lot of overlap and duplication in government. We need to reduce that, streamline government. It would address a lot of what we've talked about. If we're going to cut personnel, let's not do it indiscriminately. Mm-hmm. Let's eliminate some duplication. It's the most downloaded report in the history of GAO, and is really a roadmap for how you can transform, streamline government.
Senator Coburn has occupied, at least in this city, Deborah, a little bit different space than a lot of the small government, federal government's no good space that a lot of people in the Republican Party occupy. There are a number of people in this city, at least, that seem to be able to distinguish his ability to disconnect the concept of smaller government and efficient government efficiency and quality from the conversations. As Robert said, he's a big smaller government fan, but he also recognizes that until that day that government becomes smaller, what we have should operate as efficiently as it should, and not everybody's willing to disconnect those two concepts. People seem to want to keep them tied together.
Well, the reality, you know, in our entire economy is, and not just in, you know, in the public sector, is, and do you blame that on the recession? I don't know. You blame it on technology? Is it just what modernization is all about? Is that smaller is how things are run. Mm-hmm. Private businesses are run that way. Government is clearly getting run that way. What is it the confluence of? You know, is it the confluence of people going through a recession and realizing you can get more done with less of what you thought? But having that connection, smaller and efficient, that's what's made it able for him to have people listen, because it wasn't just smaller for a philosophical reason. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody's into the efficiencies of the government. Well, everyone who doesn't get to vote. And creating a more efficient government is clearly, it's going to be smaller. It's clearly, that's all the news stories, that's where we're all headed. My most recent sort of touch base with Senator Coburn, I was sharing with the two of you, during the break, was the 60 Minutes story on the fraud inside the Social Security Administration that he uncovered. And to watch him on 60 Minutes, great, great liberal sort of news program, advocate on behalf of the American public why it's important to, you know, be on top of these kinds of things, and why it was important to him, I found very compelling. I really did. I found it very compelling.
Is there somebody that you can see on the landscape, Robert, who will kind of take up this mantle? Because a lot of the time, it seems the things that he's advocating, whether you're for him or against him, he's about the only one pitching for him.
Yeah, I don't think the Congress is without advocates like this. Mark Warner, I think, is a very eloquent, hardworking spokesman for more effective government, and he is a fiscal conservative. I think Senator Johnson, who is a potential successor on the Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee, is also, you know, a forceful advocate. I don't think There's kind of a magic mix of talents in Senator Coburn that I think are genuinely irreplaceable. And you've got to really have a thick skin. This is a guy who doesn't give one damn about what people think about what he's doing because he's so confident it's the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sometimes, if you don't agree with him, it appears stubborn and hard-headed. But if you're on the side of smaller, smarter government, there's no better friend.
Okay, so you've given me two possible names there that could be at least to replace him in his positions in the Senate, if not his advocacy priorities. And we'll leave the political discussion about what happens in Oklahoma to other people to figure out. But what does the landscape of the Homeland Security Committee look like? How does it look different, do you think? Because he's only been the ranking member on that committee for a little over a year.
That's right. You've got in the wing Senator McCain, Senator Johnson, Senator Portman, former OMB director. It would be a pretty funny world with Senator McCain in that seat, either as ranking or
chair. I can't even imagine that. Because if they don't take the Senate back, he doesn't have to term limit off of armed services.
That's right. If the Republicans do take the Senate back, he likely moves over.
And he would want to be chair
of that committee. And then it's Johnson or Portman, I think, who are in the wings for that committee.
Interesting landscape that presents. A former OMB director possibly in that chair would be a pretty interesting turn of events, I would think.
That's right.
Certainly somebody that would know where all the bodies are buried.
Yep.
All right. Transitions were kind of a sub-story of this week. We also learned that Congressman Jim Moran will not seek re-election. Frank Wolf said a couple weeks ago that he was going to skip the re-election. And that's exactly where I wanted to head, though, in the couple of minutes that we have left. We only have a minute or so left. But if I think back to 10, 12 years ago, the coalition of members, and especially in the House of Representatives, that stood up for federal employees was bipartisan. You had Congresswoman Morella, you had Tom Davis, who we saw yesterday, and you had Frank Wolf, three Republicans to go along with Congressman Hoyer, Delegate Norton, and Congressman Moran, and others who I'm sure I'm forgetting, and I apologize for forgetting them. Now, with the departure of Congressman Wolf, he's the last Republican in the D.C. metropolitan area. What impact does that potentially have on this coalition that's not really a coalition anymore that advocates for federal employees in Congress, especially because they're all Democrats and nobody expects Republicans to give up the House anytime soon? Robert, you want to go first on that one?
There are existing members of Congress who find these issues important and who will step up. There are people running for elections right now who likewise can have a voice. But it's hard to overestimate the loss in terms of seniority and understanding of these issues. It's a pretty devastating blow. And when you're talking about reductions in force, cuts to employees, restructuring the federal government, hard to see how we find a competent, strong voice for these issues, but we ought to look. We ought to go recruiting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Debbie, what do you think?
You know, and I think, you know, what Francis, you're talking about is, you know, do you have a coalition and does it need to be bipartisan? You know, can one or two congressmen from different districts in the seat of the, you know, that surround the seat of the government make it happen for federal workers? And I think I'm with Robert. I think it's a tough act to, you know, replace, and it doesn't look like it's there yet. But time will tell, and certainly, you know, that's what elections are for. And will the federal workers who live around the D.C., you know, area, will they over time elect people who really, you know, drive their interests?
Got to leave it there. Thank you both for a terrific Federal News Countdown. It's great having both of you on the show. Deborah Roth of Shaw, Bransford & Roth, Robert Shea of Grant Thornton with his new Napa gig. Congratulations on that. Federal News Countdown back next Friday in the 4 o'clock hour.